Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 6th of November. Our guest of this hour recently served as commander of the International Space Station, conducting numerous scientific experiments, overseeing an emergency spacewalk. He has gained acclaim for his breathtaking photos and educational videos about life in space, also for his music video, a zero-gravity version of David Bowie's Space Oddity, which received over 10 million views in its first 3 days. Every time he does a new video, educational video about how you do different activities in space, it gets all kinds of hits. He's a top graduate of the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School in 1988, selected to be an astronaut in 1992, which was a lifelong dream. Capsule communicator for 25 shuttle launches, director of NASA operations in Star City, Russia from 2001 to 2003. He was chief of robotics at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. And Colonel Chris Hadfield is with us. Colonel Hadfield is the author now of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. Well, welcome phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, where if you want to hear that song, he's also a gifted singer, so if you'd like to hear that song while he's singing it in the space station, it's really wonderful. It's worth a view, so go there and see it. Colonel Chris Hadfield, thank you ever so much for being with us. Hello.
It's really my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation, Kathleen.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Before we talk about your being 9 years old and wanting to be an astronaut, and imagine you became one, I want to talk about these 92 sunrises. You see 92 sunrises in the space station?
Well, we see 16 a day, so it doesn't take long to see 92. But yeah, we see, gosh, I'd have to do the math. But we go around the world at 5 miles a second. So that's 17,500 miles an hour. So from San Diego to Boston in about 9 minutes or 10. So yeah, you it seems like every time you catch the breath and get back to work, you've come around the world once again. It's a fantastic place to see the world and to see its place in the solar system.
And it is, you're in such a rarefied group. There are, what, about 500 people who have seen the planet the way you've seen it?
Yeah, since Al Shepard launched and Yuri Gagarin back when I was, I was two. There have been 500, a little more than 500, I don't know, 510 or 520 or something that have flown in space. And I've been lucky enough to fly three times and go to a couple different space stations. But this last one, the one you were talking about, it just beat all to spend half a year up there and really get to know the whole planet was just spectacular.
I imagine. You were captivated. You write in the book about seeing the moon walk back in 1969. And was it at that point you said, this is it? I know you wanted to do this when you were nine, but what was it about the moonwalk that just captivated you?
Yeah, that was the summer of 69. I was just turning 10 that summer. I'm born in August. And, you know, it was all in the news, of course, the space race and Apollo 8 had gone around the moon, and there was all the strife of the late 60s, but there was also the big overlay of the Cold War and science fiction, of the big unknown sort of threat of the Soviet Union and their space program, but also things like Star Trek was coming on television, and 2001, A Space Odyssey was in the theater. So it was pretty heady stuff for a little 9-year-old boy, whether you were growing up in the U.S. or in Canada or anywhere around the world. And so to have that all come together, not just in a movie theater, but for real, to actually see Neil and Buzz land on the moon with incredible human ingenuity and then step out on the surface, not because they had to, but because it was just barely possible. To me, that was just immensely motivational. And I decided, I don't think I was the only kid in the world, but I decided that night as we, you know, I stayed up real late, but walked out of the house. We were at a neighbor's place because we didn't have a TV, but walked out and looked up at the moon and thought, oh, boy, those are the coolest guys in the world. I want to do that when I grow up. What do I have to do to become one of those guys?
And what's extraordinary is that you did what you had to do when you were 9 years old. You started working really, really hard.
Yeah, I was lacking direction, of course. There was no Canadian astronaut program.
Right.
It was impossible for a Canadian kid to do that. But I, you know, I thought, heck, this morning it was impossible to walk on the moon. So I'm going to try and figure out what to do. And I looked at Al Shepard and John Glenn and Mike Collins, and, you know, these were university-educated, fit test pilots. And I was growing up on a farm at the time, and I thought, well, that all sounds interesting. You know, go study how things work and learn to fly and then see what happens. And the real beauty of it, Kathleen, was not that it gave me a straight path to where I wanted to go, but instead it gave me a general direction for how to make all of the little decisions along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real key, is not that someone said, do this, do this, do this, do this, and then you'll get off at the appropriate exit. It was more like, keep this thing on the horizon, and all of the vagaries of the realities of life as they come along, it may help you choose what little things to do. And so I just always kept it as a long-term thought that maybe someday if Canada said, hey, we're looking for astronauts, I could have done as many things as possible so that when I stuck my hand up, they'd pick me.
And then lo and behold, there's an ad in a newspaper in Canada saying they're looking for astronauts.
It actually said wanted astronauts, and it was in the newspapers and the magazines in late January of 1992. And so I stuck in my application, and luckily it took about 4 months or 5 months to go through the selection process, but finally got a pretty important phone call from the space agency in Canada, and that was really the watershed of all of those years of hoping and preparing.
And what a rigorous, rigorous competition it was, Colonel Hadfield, wasn't it?
Oh gosh. I think 5,000, some odd, 5,300 something people sent in their resumes. I would not have wanted to be the person receiving 5,300 resumes in the mail and having to try and sort them. The days before internet, before email, all done via the post. But yeah, they took all of those and they weeded it down to 500 people, and then had a whole bunch more questionnaires, and then from that down to 120 people where we got interviewed, and then down to 50 people where we had a couple days worth of interviews and a basic medical, and then down to 20 people. And it's easy to say now, but it was agonizing to have to kind of put myself completely out there, I was a test pilot in my early 30s at the time, and say, these are all the things that I've done. These are my dreams. This is who I am. This is everything I can think of. And then wait and wait and wait every single threshold, and just hoping that they'd call back and say, yep, we'd like you to come to the next level. So when it got down to the final 20, we all went up to the nation's capital and had a week together, did a mock press conference and coordination tests, had to give a presentation, had a panel interview, and medicals where they looked as far into the body as you can physically look. And amongst all of that, another agonizing week of waiting, and then I did get a phone call asking if I wanted to be an astronaut, and they chose four of us
original
5,300.
I was interested in the story of you and your wife putting together this absolutely spectacular resume in English and also in French, and it made me think, maybe resumes are really important, huh?
Well, I figured, you know, if you get one shot, make it a good shot, you know? If
right.
you're only going to get one, it's not a time to, write something on the back of an envelope and sent it in. So it's like, okay, yeah, it's sort of like I do everything, but it's like, hey, what paper are we going to print this on? We are in competition with thousands of people. Well, let's do it on high quality bond linen paper and get it professionally bound and leave no detail, you know, unmentioned, and then have it perfect in both of the official languages of Canada. And just why not? You know, I would never have wanted to have 6 months later gone, well, they didn't select me because they didn't notice my resume because I did a slapdash job. So I don't know if it made any real difference, but it made me feel better to do my best at the time. And fortunately, they did read it, and they thought the decisions I'd made since I was 9 years old were were good enough that they asked me to come work there.
Tell me about how they judge this and what kind of absolutely spectacular condition your physical body has to be in, and of course your psychological body as well, because you could be, you're up there for over 100 days, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, you know, that was the worst part, Kathleen. They didn't even tell you what they were looking for. It was all just sort of all that thing, that want ad that was in the papers, all it said was be a citizen of the country, have a university degree, and be able to pass a medical. That's all it said. And so the rest of it was sort of guesswork of what they might be looking for. We didn't even know how many people they were going to be hiring. So it was very unnerving to go through. Looking back at it now, the three main thing, and it's true for I've been an astronaut for a long time now, and I've seen how the selections go in all of the astronaut corps around the world. The three things they were truly looking for, and they still are, is a proven ability to learn at a high level. And so that's why they look for an advanced university degree, a proven ability to make good decisions when the consequences matter. And that's why they hire people like test pilots and medical doctors. Not that they need medical doctors and test pilots as much as they need people who can make good decisions. And then the third part is, as you mentioned, to be able to pass, which for the space station is, I think, the hardest physical in the world just to qualify for your job. And not that we're some sort of Olympian level of fitness. It's just that you can't have any congenital problems. You can't have any nagging little question mark problems such that there could be a problem while you're away from the Earth that they would have to abandon ship for, because the consequences of that are very high. So they eliminate the vast majority of the people just purely on medical grounds. In fact, there are lots of people in the astronaut office now who were chosen during the shuttle era where their medicals were okay for a short duration flight like the shuttle, but they're not good enough for a flight, as you say, that's over 100 days. So yeah, it's really stringent. And so in all of that, you have to be kind of driven, you have to be focused, but also you have to be lucky.
Right. Well, it also, I was interested in what happens. We'll talk about what happens in space, but I never heard anybody write about or talk about what happens when you enter the Earth again and how hard it is on the body. And I was wondering why, to get used to gravity. You get physically sick when you get home.
It would be so nice to be up on the space station with you, and you could see how just how graceful and dream ballet-like it is, and lovely and effortless it is to live in weightlessness. It's like swans swimming gracefully on the surface of a pond, although it's better than that. You're flying effortlessly the whole time, and you get so smooth and graceful at it. And then the day comes after half a year in space that you worm your way into your little Soyuz spaceship. My third flight was with the Russians on the Soyuz. The first two was on the shuttle. But on my third flight, you worm your way in, wearing your pressure suit, into your Soyuz. You strap yourself hard into your crash seat. And in fact, you don't just sit in a chair. You have a crash seat for returning to Earth. And then the vehicle plummets into the atmosphere, essentially a slightly steerable meteorite. Yeah. And you come rocketing through the atmosphere with high forces, and then a huge parachute opens and takes you straight down. But you land in Kazakhstan on the prairie there, the steppe of Kazakhstan, so it's windy, sort of like it is in, unlike Michigan today. And it comes down with this big sideways force, and you slam into the ground. I mean, it's as if you were standing on the top of a semi, like a tractor trailer, a semi. If you could picture it driving down the road at 20 or 30 miles an hour and you jumping off the top of that, that's about the vertical speed and the horizontal speed. That's the type of bang and roll. And your ship weighs a couple tons. So you hit the ground, the Earth knows your back, and it is pretty rugged inside. In fact, the Russians remind you in training, remember, just before landing, stop talking so you don't bite your tongue off.
That's
how violent the landing's going to be. So, yeah, it's a reliable, predictable, repeatable way to get back to the Earth, but it is not elegant.
Ooh, did you keep your eyes open?
Yeah. I kept my eyes open and my mouth shut and landed fine. Didn't get hurt at all. But, of course, then as soon as you land, now suddenly you are victimized by gravity again. You're under the tyranny of gravity, where the first thing I noticed was when I wanted to talk, you actually have to pick up your tongue to talk. that I, oddly enough, I'd gotten used to talking with a weightless tongue, and my lips had been weightless. My first reaction was, wow, I'd never noticed before that lips and tongue have mass and that you have to actually lift them again. And it's weird to talk standing on your head. So, and then you have to pick your arm up. But the worst symptoms are that your balance system is so confused because it's been relying totally on what your eyes have been saying for months and months. And now it's got gravity. It's got this acceleration vector coming down through your inner ear that it doesn't have any idea what to do with. And it's confused. And so for the last, I don't know, million years or so, when there's a big disconnect between what your inner ear is saying and what your eyes are saying, it's often been because you ate something poisonous, you know, a bad mushroom or some neurotoxin or something. And so your body's immediate instinctive reaction is throw up, get rid of whatever is caught because it may kill you. And then the other thing is go lie down. So you stop digesting it. So you stop metabolizing it. So your body, as soon as you get back to Earth, it's issuing you great urgent commands to throw up and go to sleep. And it's a rude and unfair way to be welcomed home after 6 months of grace.
6 months of grace. What a way to put that. I'd like to experience that, but I could never go through the hell the whole thing of taking off in a spaceship. It's unimaginable, but written about beautifully by Colonel Chris Hadfield, who is our guest this hour, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. He is our guest this hour. He's also, if you haven't seen the video, it's just beautiful, and it received 3 days after it was on YouTube. It just got millions of hits from all over the world. He's also a very accomplished guitarist and singer. So go to our Facebook page if you want to see him singing. It's really, if you want to have a feeling of what he just experienced in talking about weightlessness and the grace of the whole thing, it's captured in his video. And he's done many other videos as well. He was an astronaut for a number of years, just recently retired, and we're welcoming phone calls for him as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll play a little bit of his singing in space, and then we'll be back and welcome your phone calls. This is the Ideas Network, and here, as the Washington Post wrote in a review about his book, is the singer. Houston, we have a superstar.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on.
10.
Ground control
9,
to Major Tom.
8, 7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Detach from station and may God's love be with you.
Our guest this hour is the author of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. And that was him singing as well. And you sing as well. You got so many talents, Colonel.
I've always liked music, like a lot of people, and I've actually fronted bands for the last 20 years or so, a couple of different bands, or bands are sometimes short-lived, but a succession of bands down in Houston. But I had a guitar on the space station. It's still up there, in fact, for psychological support for the crews. I played guitar pretty much every night and wrote a bunch of music up there and recorded a whole CD's worth up. And I did a collaborative thing with the band called the Bare Naked Ladies that Ed Robertson and I wrote that was sung live through a charity with 700,000 students live. We all sang that song together when I was on the space station. They all learned it. They had an assembly. They went outside in the courtyard of their school last May And the entire country of Canada belted out this song called Is Somebody Singing? ISS, about hope vision pride and the things that we can do. So, yeah, music's really important at all different levels. And I was delighted to be able to include it as part of what we were doing up there.
Yeah. I think somebody has a question about that. One of our listeners, Riley in Appleton. Hi, Riley.
Hi. Well, first, I guess I'd like to say, thank you for... being you, for one thing. You're
thank
an inspiration
you, Riley.
To people everywhere. I've got little kids at home, and my 7-year-old, ISS, that's her favorite song. She'll tell everybody. she requests it all the time, and playing it on YouTube and whatnot. And that's just amazing. I guess the question I had, though, was when you recorded that song, was that live? I mean, I know it was live, but was there a time delay?
So, Riley, you and your daughter are referring to when I did the video back and forth with Ed Robertson, or when I sang it live with your daughter at the other schools?
I'm actually American.
But it was available on the net. People all around the world sang it live with me, so I was just checking. Do you mean then the recorded version that we did?
The recorded version with the Bare Naked Ladies, yeah.
Yeah, there is no way to do two-way back and forth because it's about a 1.5 to 2 second lag each direction. So if I started singing and then was relying on like listening on a set of headphones to hear them joining in with me with the lag, there'd just be no way to do it. So what I did was we talked about it. I recorded my whole part and sent it down, and then they played along with my part real time as if I was there with them. So like most music videos, it's things put together from different sources. But, when Ed was driving to do that morning, Ed Robertson of the Bare Naked Ladies, he was like busy and looking at his watch and going, how did I get roped into doing this song? I got so much to do. And he got to the studio and saw that set and that choir of kids and started singing the song with the part that I'd recorded. And it was like magic. Mm. And the finished product just came out. It puts tears in my eyes to see just how lovely that turned out and how beautifully it expresses what Ed and I were thinking when we were setting out to write the song. So, with a little bit of technical wizardry and then a lot of surprising human emotion, it really came out well.
Another moment of grace for you. It sounds like you've had many.
I have as many as life will allow me, yeah. Hmm.
You write about, it's not often we think about this word and what it means. I like this, though. You talk about competence in the book and that it's the most important quality to have if you're an astronaut or, frankly, anyone, anywhere. Can you tell me what that means, competence, to you?
Of course, in my profession, it's easy. When I was a test pilot and as an astronaut, at the absolute core of everything is both a necessity and expectation that you will know the things that you need to know. Otherwise, you will die. Our job is very risky and mistakes are fatal. And so the absolute assumption is you will do all the work in advance. You will learn all of the fine, arcane details of it. You will become as expert as possible at all of those systems so that when the time comes to push a particular button or not push a particular button, you'll know and you won't let yourself and everybody down. So it's pretty easy to look at in our profession, but I really view it right across the board. I was recently approached, several times, please sign this petition online on this particular issue. Please do something on this issue. To me, it is so much more important to first truly understand the issue. Don't just react based on belief, but to truly understand the issue. Dig in, become technically competent so that you are really conversant with the details of it. Truly understand what it is that you're having an input into, that you can affect, and then figure out what you should do in order to have, the impact that's important to you. And competence, to me, is the core. It's what separates us from the other species. Who can make fire? Who can't? Who can remember what their mother told them and who cannot? We have to be always seeking to be as competent and as educated and as capable as possible in order to to move forwards. And so it's at the very core of both my profession and what I think is the best of human behavior.
John in Oshkosh, hi.
I know, but then I have to keep it running.
John, are you there?
Oh, hi.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
It's a big honor to have you take my call, Colonel Hatfield. I was also 9 years old when they landed on the moon, and I had been in, I was a big space nut, you know, since like 65, you know, in Gemini and everything.
And, we're getting old, aren't we, John?
I mean, you never seen a kid so disappointed when the networks decided to bump the, you know, subsequent moon landings. And, you know, so there was nothing on TV, and those were, you know, those days advanced in technology, so everything was color, and it was just great, you know? Mm-hmm. But I had some reference books because, you know, I mean, I was engulfed in this, the astronauts in the space program. So I had an address for NASA. So I went ahead and mailed NASA and asked them for some material. Huge package comes back.
Really?
And yes, and it had hardcover books.
Oh.
And yes, I was just astounded. I was so happy. Yeah, you know.
You're still happy, John. Oh, it's the things in life that we remember. That was nice of them.
Yeah, what's interesting out of that era also is that there were more PhDs per capita. People were motivated just for the same reason that John is, the childish delight, but then also the huge interaction of the technical side of things, that there were more people went on to advanced education directly as a result of that inspiration than has ever happened in the history of the country. It was immensely motivational for people to become competent and to really push themselves to try and figure out how things work. It had a big influence outside of just the straight technical return of understanding the moon itself.
Thanks for your enthusiasm and for calling, John. Obviously, things aren't always idyllic and full of grace. There were moments when you lost astronauts who were very good friends of yours, and it's hard for me to imagine how you take that in and how you carry on in an occupation that, as you just said, is very risky. You can't make mistakes.
Yeah, it's unforgiving. And we made a couple egregious mistakes in the history of the shuttle program back in 86, where we elected to launch when it was too cold in Florida. And we didn't really understand the behavior, even though there'd been hints of it. The shuttle had been trying to tell us, you know, if we just truly paid attention, there'd been hints that there was a little bit of sort of rocket exhaust coming out the side of the solid rockets. And on a really cold day, because the seals were cold and hard, it was the worst, and it led to the Challenger accident. And then for Columbia, with my friends on board, because I'd been in the program for quite a while already, we had a piece of foam come off that during launch, which always happens. I mean, it's a bunch of insulation. You always lose little bits of foam. But we had a big one that just hit in like the one of the most fragile areas, and we didn't understand it, and we couldn't see it, was the worst thing. Once the vehicle got up and to orbit, we didn't have a robot arm on that particular flight. So we couldn't, you know, like trying to look into your own armpit, we couldn't swing around and have a good look at where the foam had hit the shuttle. So we guessed, and we thought, well, you know, we've seen foam come off before, and we think it's okay. We, you know, based on our best engineering judgment and the realities of where we are, we think we're all okay. And so we let them come back into the atmosphere, and there was a hole in the wing. Mm. And it, you know, it blowtorched its way through and melted off the wing, and the crew and the vehicle were both lost. And you know, at the personal level, it was just awful, course. But it was so horrifically public. You know, it was people from all around the world saw the loss of our friends and the huge mistake we'd made. And if anything, if agony can be exaggerated, it was. Mm. But like anything else, what really matters is, what do you do now? What do you do next? And there were a lot of people said, quit. You're killing people. Stop doing this. It's not worth it. But new things are almost always hard. And exploration is a long history of taking risks in order to understand something better. And we regularly put citizens in harm's way as part of our society. We expect soldiers to die. We expect policemen to die. We expect test pilots to die. It's not that we want them to. It's just something that happens, and it's not newsworthy when it does happen. For whatever reason, we do not expect astronauts to die, which I'm thankful for. But in the astronaut corps, we do expect astronauts to die. We understand that it's risky, and we're not always going to get it just right. That's why competence is so important.
Yes.
But also, what you do next is really fell to us. And we had to, number one, stop damaging the shuttle during ascent. Number two, be able to look and see if we had damage after we got to orbit. And number three, be able to repair damage. We had to invent all three of those things before we could ever fly in space again. And rather than quit, or rather than just slink off, that's what we addressed for the next 2.5-3 years, full time. And I, as you mentioned in the intro, I was chief of robotics for the astronaut office at the time, so I was working with a huge team of people, because robotics were part of both inspecting and repairing, of course, of how we could do all those things. And we came up with elegant solutions to all three, gathered our nerve, and launched another crew a few years later. And to our credit, which probably gets forgotten, we flew the shuttle, I think, I don't know, 25 times more after that, never hurt one more person, completed building the space station, did a repair mission to the Hubble telescope, which is the most capable telescope humans have ever built, and is now up there for another decade, probably telling us about the universe,
right.
All riding on the new capability and learned lessons that were earned through the loss of a bunch of lives of friends of mine.
Colonel Chris Hadfield, his book is An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. We're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655 here on the Ideas Network. And we go to Bob next. Hi, Bob.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks so much for allowing me to speak with Colonel Hadfield.
Hello, Bob.
I just wanted to... Hello. I followed the space program for a long time, and the mission that I found to be most amazing actually was Apollo 8 with Borman, Lovell, and Anders, you know, in Christmas of 68. And the moment that I think was most interesting, and I wonder if you had one of these moments, is when they came around the backside of the moon and they saw the Earth, and I think it was Colonel Borman said, you know, We went to the moon, but at that moment we really kind of lost interest in the moon because we were looking back at the Earth and how fragile and how beautiful it was. And I know your missions were low Earth orbit, but you know, you talk of the moment of grace, and I haven't read your book, but I certainly will. But I just wondered if you had one of those, or if there was just a series of epiphanies, because you spent your whole life, you know, with your nose to the grindstone working towards this goal, and then when you get there, all of a sudden you have this, you know, this world floating below you, this thing that represents everything we ever was and ever will be. Mm. And how did that affect you?
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. And those first Apollo astronauts, I was actually with a couple of them yesterday, Walt Cunningham and Alan Bean down in Houston, talking to them about it. Of course, they saw the world in such a new way. They could cover up the world with their thumb, you know, and to put yourself into that perspective and to think, to try and get yourself comfortable with that. Either you can completely brutally ignore it and just go, okay, I can cover up the world with my thumb and I'm not going to think about it. Or you can recognize the distances and the fragility and the incredible rareness of our tiny little Earth. Which looks vast and impregnable when you're walking around here on the surface, but you ask about my experience going around the world, you see this tiny little sliver that we live in between the incredible heat of the magma and lava that is almost our entire planet. We live on this tiny, cooled little crust. And there's a lot of places around the world where the magma's pouring through. You can see volcanoes erupting all around the world. And if you go the other way, we have to live in about the bottom 3 miles of the atmosphere. That above that, we really can't live. The air is too thin. So we live in this little sliver that is just this tiny little habitable volume. And as I go around the world, or went around the world about 2,500 times, I think that same sense of wonder and fragility and rarity and necessity for a level of responsibility and stewardship, it just becomes inexorably a part of you. Mm. And it teaches a huge respect for this place we live and a better understanding of it. And it's not like I'm some sort of evangelist about it, but it's just a real deepening. And after a little while, when I look down at people, and I was using Twitter and social media, but I just couldn't help but start referring to everything as us. You know, this is where 4 million of us live. Look at this picture of Canberra. You know, here's 750,000 of us live right here, and that feeling was undeniable. And I did my absolute best in the 5 months up there to try and let people come on board and look through my camera and maybe hopefully share that feeling a little bit.
I know that you, in simple ways, did things like making sure that things were picked up when you were on the ground, that litter was very troubling to you. Have you become an activist in other areas? Do you worry about global warming or endangered species or any of those large issues that are before us now?
I try not to be worried about things. I try instead to become informed about things and then do things that I think are important towards them. There's not a lot of point in worrying about global warming. I mean, that's pointless. First, we need to understand what extent it's caused by natural processes, which is part of it, what extent it's caused by human processes, which is part of it, and therefore, what can we do about it? I mean, on my first space flight, it was shortly after Mount Pinatubo had erupted in the Philippines. One sort of not that significant a volcano down in the Philippines, it put enough sulfur dioxide and ash into the upper atmosphere that it cooled the whole world by almost a degree. One little volcano in the early 90s. So there are huge natural forces at play. But also when you go around the world, you see the vast pollution across the big populated centers, the big gray smear of Mexico City or the LA Basin or Beijing. And then a place like the Aral Sea in eastern Europe and Asia, just to the left of Kazakhstan, where an entire inland sea, you know, the size of Lake Michigan, that has been dried up and is basically gone completely because of human mismanagement. Mm-hmm. So we can have, obviously, an enormous effect. And I'm from the Great Lakes areas. I watch the level of the Great Lakes going down, and I immediately think of the Aral Sea, and the level in the Great Lakes now is as low as it's been in our recorded history, back in the 20s and the 30s and today. And what are the causes of that? It's not that I'm worried about it. I want to know. I've done a lot of research about it, and I'm trying to figure out why the water is at the level it is and what we can do. If it's unavoidable, then how we can live with it. But if it's something we can modify, what actions can we take to try and fix it? But I'm not sure I'm an activist yet. I just got back from space.
Right,
but
okay.
I'm definitely trying to figure out which battles to fight so that hopefully, you know, over the next 30 or 40 years that I have, that I can try and do something worthwhile.
Hmm. And it sounds like all the training you received to become an astronaut will fit in just perfectly for those tasks, right? I think it will.
I hope so. Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Our guest this hour is the author of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. Colonel Chris Hadfield is our guest. What going to space taught me about ingenuity, determination, and being prepared for anything. He when he was 9 years old, wanted to be an astronaut. He grew up in Canada, and there weren't any Canadian astronauts. So by a series of hard work, he really worked hard to prepare himself to be good at whatever he was going to do. But there was an article in a newspaper, a Canadian newspaper, wanted astronauts. And so he went through the laborious procedure of becoming one and being interviewed. And He's done so many remarkable things. He recently served as commander of the International Space Station, where he conducted all kinds of scientific experiments. We need to talk about some of those. And overseeing an emergency spacewalk, we should talk about that. He's been capsule communicator for 25 shuttle launches. He was director of NASA operations in Star City, Russia for several years, chief of robotics at the Johnson Space Center, and has been on three space trips. Isn't that amazing? Three space trips. And is talking about all that he's experienced. And we're welcoming phone calls. Bob, thanks for your call. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page where we have his song. Please see it. You'll be inspired this afternoon. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today is Governor Walker nears his decision about the Menominee Casino proposal for Kenosha. We started thinking about all the other tribes that are have built casinos as a source of income for their tribes. Are they a significant contribution to the well-being of Native Americans in this country? Why did they choose casinos as a source of income? Are there alternatives that may be just as profitable? We're going to talk about all of that with Chief George Philip Tiger, who is Principal Chief of the Muscogee Creek Nation in Oklahoma. So that's coming up hour two. This hour, Colonel Chris Hadfield, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, is what we're talking about. And let us go to Tony in Fond du Lac. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Great show. Hello, Colonel. Another guy who grew up a space nut as a kid, and hearing your enthusiasm just takes me right back to that.
Mm-hmm.
I missed the portion of the conversation where you were talking about having your guitar on the space station, but I was wondering, did the lack of gravity affect the tuning of your guitar or how the guitar played, or were there any little challenges to overcome playing the guitar in space?
Yeah, thanks. So this is how you play guitar in space, Tony. First, you have to convince somebody to get a guitar up there. It's not easy to get one. But fortunately, we brought one up for psychological support on the space shuttle in August of 2001. So there's one up on the space station. And it's an acoustic. And it actually, the tuning of the strings doesn't change because the humidity stays the same and the temperature stays the same. So the wood of the guitar doesn't flex and change. But to play it is weird because it doesn't hang in front of you on a strap or rest with gravity comfortably on your knee, but in fact it's sort of flying in front of you. And when you move your left hand up and down the fretboard, you know, if you come up to bar chord partway up, the guitar just moves along with your hand and takes off to the right as you move your hand up and down. So you have to find a new way to brace the guitar solidly against you. I think maybe a big Velcro button in the back of it might have been a good idea, or something to stick it to my chest. But eventually I figured out how to get clean cording out of it. And also you don't have the weight of your arm. So when you're reaching for the chords with your left hand, you miss a little bit because you're used to different cues. But after a while you can learn to be a weightless guitarist.
There you go,
Absolutely
Tony.
Absolutely fascinating. Can't wait to read the book. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks.
Don in Boscobel, hello.
Hello. I'm curious. I've watched spacewalks numerous times, and it always seems so awkward. You're constantly bouncing around, floating, as it were, and trying to grab on. Is it really that awkward? And could you also describe some of the tools you use when you have drivers that have torque? Are they compensated for in the machine, or do you have to brace yourself, et cetera?
Yeah, good question. Spacewalking is extremely ungainly. It's sort of like putting on the worst winter snowmobile suit and then ice skates. And then while you're standing on your ice skates to try and do small engine repair and work with a chainsaw and everything else, it's very improbable what we're doing. And you need to find a way to brace yourself. Also, the suit is very restrictive. It's a pressure suit. You know, just to squeeze your hands is like squeezing a tennis ball. So if you want to put your hand around a set of ice grips, it's the same sort of force as just squeezing a tennis ball. So it's very physical. Typically, you come back inside having rubbed yourself raw, you know, drawn blood somewhere around your body, and your hands and forearms are worn out, you know, just beat by the time you're done. And we stay outside typically for 6, 7, maybe 8 hours. In order to drive the tools, we have hundreds of different tools, but a lot of them you'd recognize just as standard, you know, ones from the hardware store. Some of our drills that you're talking about do have a locking mechanism so that when you engage it, you don't get a back torque into you. But a lot of them don't. You just have to drive a bolt head somewhere. Typically, we use 7/16 everywhere. We just decided, let's just put 7/16 everywhere so we don't have to bring a whole bunch of ratchets out there. And so what you have to do is brace your body. And we have a bunch of different ways of doing that, sort of a little stiff stick that's attached to your chest that you can attach to a handrail in front of you. Or more rigidly, you can snap your feet into what we call a foot restraint, or APFR, articulated portable foot restraint. And that's sort of like getting your feet firmly on the floor so that then you can handle the torque of turning something with a wrench while, in fact, you're floating weightless. But it is not an inherently normal place to work. Like I don't know, operating a chainsaw while floating in a swimming pool. It's bizarre.
Thanks, Don. Diana in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I'm a big fan, and I followed you on Twitter, and I downloaded a lot of your imagery. I don't know if that's okay or not.
That's fine, yeah.
With my students.
Oh.
Anyhow, I was wondering, since you're interested in music and photography, how you see art as helping innovation in science or other fields?
I think they are inextricably linked. And people talk about science, technology, you know, engineering, math, art. You know, a lot of people talk about STEAM instead of STEM. Art is really important, and a lot of astronauts are musicians. Alan Bean, who I said I was talking to yesterday, he walked on the moon. He's a test pilot, but he's a painter and a sculptor and a terrific painter and sketch artist. And the creativity of the mind is what we're trying to do out there. And, you know, the whole purpose of the book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, that's kind of the point of it. We're not trying to figure out how to be an astronaut. Who really cares what I do out in space? What's vital out of it is what does it mean to us back on Earth? What inventions can we bring back to Earth? What new insights into maybe materials or engineering come back to Earth? But also, what is the perspective that it gives us back on Earth to be able to see the whole planet? The pictures that you looked at and they inspired you enough to download them to show them to your students, Dan, but the art of it. And now the space station is big enough and capable enough and stable enough that we can start to use it as an artistic platform. And that's, we have musicians up there. We write music. I wrote a lot of music, and that's part of my motivation in having done the song with all the kids as well as the Bowie tribute video, to let people see that this is just kind of a new stage. This month is the 13th anniversary of leaving Earth permanently.
Oh,
we've
is.
Had people on the space station for the last 13 years, and it is an amazing new platform of an ability to see ourselves in perspective, and art is very much a part of that.
The other thing I liked about your book, I mean, you are a man of many talents, but you have a very philosophical portion of the book where you say, you know, it doesn't make any sense to get too full of yourself, that our accomplishments will soon be filled by others who will have other accomplishments, and we're part of just a long chain of human accomplishment and certain things, and not to in any way downgrade what you've done, which is truly spectacular, but that you're part of a humanity experience in all of this. It's not just you. You don't want yourself to be the star.
Yeah, and the space station is inherently humbling because I was the commander of the space station, you know,
right,
which is the world spaceship. I was the commander of world's spaceship, but I was the 35th commander of the world spaceship, Expedition 35. You know, it's like, you know, James Bond 3, James Bond 4. Well, now we're at James Bond 35. You know, it's you have to like remind yourself, hey, you know, this is really important for you, and you're doing your very best, and you're hoping to have as positive an influence as possible. And when it's your turn to be pulling on the oars of this boat, to have done it as well as you possibly can. But recognize that you're not the first nor the last, and that the real only measurable effect of what you've done will be how it echoes with other people in the short term and
right.
the long term. So pull hard on that oar, do your best, but don't lose sight of how it fits into everything else.
Nonetheless, you are one remarkable human being. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, our pleasure. Colonel Chris Hadfield, our guest this hour. The book is An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. Go to our Facebook page to see this song performed in space. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, KP Whaley, and Robin Cherry for producing this program. Another hour coming up. Stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.